Hello, colleagues. We are so happy to be making this recording for you. Gathered here today are members of our UUMA Right Relationship Team and two of our colleagues in the UUMA who we've invited to be in conversation with us. So first, I'd like to start by introducing you to who's here on the call. I'm Melissa Carvel-Zemer. I'm one of the co-directors of the UUMA. And in that role, I work with all of our Good Offices teams, including this one, the Good Offices Right Relationship Team. I use she, her pronouns, and I am currently in my office at my house. I have a screen behind me. I have light olive skin and dark hair, and I'm wearing a brown shirt with a green scarf. And I'm really happy to be here in this conversation. Om Prakash. John Gilmore, may I invite you?
Hello, everyone. My name is John Gilmore, also known as Om Prakash. I am a retired minister right now, but doing work in spiritual direction and life coaching. I was doing a lot of health and wellness and body work and things like that. At present, I am on the National Board of Cups and taking all the experience I've had before while I was in the ministry, doing teaching, studying, grief counseling, and negotiating and all of that in order to try to use it in the work that we're doing right now. I'm living in the Philadelphia area. Right now I am in a room with a many things in the background, a mirror, a witch's ball, they called it, in the corner. And the shade in the corner, I am a black person with a white beard, glasses, and a headset on. And I'm just glad to be here. Diane.
Hi, I'm Diane Teichert. I'm one of the designated good officers for people with disabilities. And before that, I was a chapter good officer for the Chesapeake UUMA chapter. I am disabled from a stroke, hemorrhagic stroke, which left me hemiplegic. And so I had to resign and retire earlier than I would have liked. I would say that my work as a good officer has had some, probably one of the most challenging parts of my ministry was as a good officer. And I continue to struggle with and remember the memories of that, which point me in the direction in part of this conversation today. I live in Maryland, right outside DC, in the land of the Piscataway people. And my setting is a sun porch, which we converted to my office after my stroke. And there's some plants around and a daybed back there. And I'm pretty pink colored white person. And I have increasingly white hair. And I wear glasses. Call on John Alou.
Hello, Jonalu Johnstone, she, her, I identify as a white lesbian woman. I have been a good offices person in different districts for many, many years. I worked with the accountability team of the guidelines committee when we revised the guidelines to move toward more restorative practices rather than punitive practices in our relations among one another. I am living in southern Oklahoma, the land assigned to Chickasaw people. And like Diane, I'm in a sunroom, but the gray curtains behind me block out that sun. And I have long gray hair now, which is a change, and wear glasses, and I'm wearing a red turtleneck and black vest. And I'll call on Lynn to introduce herself.
Hi, I'm Lynn Gardner. Pronouns are she and they. I am in my home in Schenectady, New York, where I serve as co-minister of our congregation here, along with Wendy Bartell. I have longish, grayish, blondish, curly hair, and I am wearing reading glasses, and my background is blurred. And I have been having technology issues, and so I do not know who has not gone yet. I apologize.
I can go. I misheard and thought I heard my name called earlier. Apologies. I'm Ren Roe McFadden. I don't use pronouns. I identify as genderqueer and two-spirit, and I am one of the early dedicated good offices focusing on disability and Indigenous issues. Most recently, I became the good offices person for the Disabled Ministers chapter. I'm honored to be here to try and bring a bit of reflection from an Indigenous lens to this Right Relations team, and great to be among colleagues. I appear white passing, though I'm kind of brown, shaved head, and today wearing a purple sweater, sitting in my home office, which is often commented to look like a hobbit house. Sloped, very sloped roof ceilings, and very blue as well. Great to be with you. I'll turn it over to Clyde.
I'm Clyde Grubbs. I'm a minister in Massachusetts, in the land of the Massachusetts people. And I have served the UUMA in various capacities a bunch of years, actually, starting in the 90s. But I helped work on the development of the Right Relations team and concept in the UUMA. I served the congregation in Canton, Massachusetts, where Diane once served. And I grew up in a situation where I was able to witness Right Relations work among traditional Cherokee and institutional Cherokee who were trying to reprogram the social work aspects of the thing. And it's well developed now. It wasn't 40 years ago or 50 years ago or even 80 years ago, was it? But now the people are trained to do Right Relations restoration work a little bit as a kind of recognition of the people. So I have some thoughts on that which I'll express in our conversation.
Thank you, Clyde. I also want to recognize and appreciate the three members of our team who weren't able to be part of our recording today. That's Maria Cristina Vasidis-Bergoa, Andre Mall, and Heather Kincannon, also part of the UMA Right Relationship team. So just a little bit of context for how we came to be making this recording today. Most UMA members who have been around for a little while know that several years ago, we appointed a guidelines team to revise our guidelines. And we actually appointed two that were working concurrently, one focused on ethics and one focused on accountability. And the result of that guidelines work was the recommendation that we move away from legalistic approaches to resolving conflict and responding to harm, and instead to move toward more restorative ways of resolving conflict and responding to harm. And specific guidelines changes were presented to the members who engaged in study, refined those changes, and then ultimately voted to accept significant changes to our guidelines. After that happened, we in the UUMA created a developmental or a transitional team to start to build a good office's specialty in right relationship. Some of the folks still on the team were part of that. There were others who came in just for that developmental work and then transitioned off into other things. What I did personally during that time in my role with the UMA and working with good offices is try to deepen my learning. So I engaged in lots of conversations with lots of people in the UMA who engage in restorative justice work, read lots of books, and took two training programs. And what has happened, the more I learned about restorative practices and the history of restorative justice work in particular in white Western society, the more I feel like I wonder if we know what we're doing in the UUMA. And the more I feel that it's complicated to try to shift an organization like the UUMA with its particular history and culture and practice to a restorative approach. So I keep having those conversations. And at one point I just thought, I wish the members of the UMA could be in on these conversations. And then I thought, well, they can, we'll just record one. And so I'm really happy that that's what we're doing here today. I've had a chance to talk a lot with Clyde. Clyde helped with the development of the team and some with Ren. And specifically in my conversations with both of them, I thought I would love to just have them talk to the team and talk to the members. So that's what we're doing here today. And I want to start by asking a few questions of Clyde and Ren. So in our conversations with both of you, you've talked about your experience being raised in or living in Indigenous communities that are culturally restorative in orientation and in values and in practice. In particular, Ren, you talked about like your family experience and how the women in the community, the people who identify as the mothers and the grandmothers and the aunties, cared for the children in the community. And Clyde, you've talked about your experience with elders, tribal leadership, and in Indigenous legal settings. And I just think that you both have so much lived experience that really informs what it means to be restorative in culture and practice. And I'm wondering what you might like to say to the members about that.
Having 1,000 years of practice helps. I think that one of the things that what I observe about the UMA is this very short period of time, and we therefore to judge us is not to make the judgment we don't know what we're doing is to say we're just beginning. I would rather reformulate it that way. And second, I think it is a culture change, and the number of people working on in a culture change toward restorative ways of being in the UUMA is tiny. And so you have to achieve at least 60% of the UUMA who could articulate why we're doing it and why the practice is before you can say that you've even begun a culture change. When such a small group of doing it, you're just foretelling, and that's a very stand on a mountain and shout. You're foretelling that we're going to have a culture change someday. If the UUMA board has a conversation about how to do this and develops a thing and says it's going to take 10, 15 years, then I'll say that we have taken the path, but we haven't, we're just starting to talk about taking a path now. We're kind of buying maps at the store, but we're not doing restorative justice at the chapter level, at the new member level. I remember, several of us do, when we just began the journey toward wholeness. Now that's had a huge impact on the UUMA and the UUA. I swear I can talk to just about any somebody who graduated from theological school in the last 10 years, and they have a whole different way of looking at the world than the people who were coming out of theological school in the 1990s and 1980s. But that's time in making institutional changes in the curriculum and in the study and the practice. And so the first thing I could say about what the indigenous experience is, it took time, it took practice and took repair, because it didn't always work. And you couldn't say, well, our techniques are the problem. And you just say, we'll try better next time.
Clyde, I agree with you that this is just the very beginning, right? I mean, I think restorative practice holds a lot of potential for the UUMA as a means of holding our people together and to do so with less trauma, I think. You know, my experience, as you said, Melissa, you know, my experience is not from like a formal restorative justice or practice structures in my community, but of Indigenous families and community who, I think, because of 1,000 years of practice, the process is really contingent on the worldview. And so culture change is difficult, institutional change is difficult. And so drawing from something that is so strongly aligned with an Indigenous worldview, I think won't come without some major adjustments and maybe shifting the expectations of what the you think your results or outcomes are going to be. What is the goal? So what was evident for me in my experience, you know, growing up, was that whenever there was conflict or a crisis, somebody was having major troubles, the wake of that person or those person, that group's troubles, rippled into the rest of the family, the community, right? So it's understanding that one person's conflict really ripples out. And likewise, there's, you know, it was felt there was a communal responsibility to bring people together. But it happened, I think, less in a structured kind of performative checkbox kind of a way. It was, I think, a more spontaneous calling in and gathering in of people. It always seemed to me, too, that there was always it became evident that there was a particular elder or knowledge keeper or someone in the community who would inevitably have an important role to play in the particular situation. And it's not like there's a recruitment of a particular person for the role, you know, but there is someone who seems organically to be called into the role of gathering people in. The key things is that it's not focused on the change or outcomes of, you know, that the job will be saved or you know, litigation or, you know, all these, that the outcomes will, I don't think it's about outcomes. I think it's about healing more than anything. And that the healing itself is holes. The restorative or the justice lens comes through the healing work. I think when we talk about justice and injustice, the concept isn't just like about spoken words, right? Because injustice is about hurt and pain. So that brings it into parts of our body and including the heart and soul. And so this talking, you know, the talking, the gathering in, I think really is an embodied practice too, and really becoming aware that someone is listening and caring. I don't want to get too deep into my own, you know, personal stuff. Clyde, I wonder if you have thoughts on to date what you have experienced using restorative practices at the UUMA.
I think we the principle of is the to restore the people to covenant, and the, what we need to establish is the power of covenant, and I don't think that's been done. I mean, the idea that the covenant is, because what you're, when you're restoring in an indigenous community, say that you're using restorative practice in an indigenous community, the idea of returning to the worldview, the way of the people, has that just saying that has legitimacy. And for an elder to say that, it has power. You say the way our people live is the red way, the red road, the words that are used to describe it has power. It is rooted in the definition of who we are. And my experience, at least, is that we're still winning that concept of covenant. That means that there are a percentage of UUMA members who have what are articulate, who want to be based in covenant, but there are people who consider it instrumental to be something you salute, but not necessarily the definition of who they are. The idea that ministry is something that an individual does, rather than ministry is a community of people who do something together, and that we're interdependent on one another. That's still to be won. And if it's not won by the UUMA through a culture struggle, it's not gonna, restore covenant, it doesn't have the same meaning as to restore the village. The village has left the red road if the young people run through somebody's garden and pick apples off a tree before they're supposed to be picked up, that is the in our words, Cherokee words, the balance has been broken. That's important. It's almost like the universe is, the stars are not in orbit anymore. It's a big deal. So I don't think we got the big deal established at the present time. For example, I'll just give a practice, for example. Say that something happened and among the 14 and 15-year-olds in the village. The 14 and 15-year-olds are told to go off and discuss it and come back with the results of their discussion. And so before they're adults, before they've had their ceremony of adult naming, they are already taking responsibility for one another in terms of right relationships, or what we would call right conduct. So the people are trained from an early age, not by taking lessons that can be written down, but rather by practice. You don't use that slingshot that way. That could get you hurt, or you're shooting the wrong kind of bird. That could be a conversation too. So that it's practice, practice, practice. And I don't think that the UMA at this point can be said to practice it widely enough. And I think that requires a core of people to constantly articulate what right relationships are, why it is inherent to be what we are as a covenantal community of ministers, and why it's called, why it's a transformation from the old model of an association of professionals who, that we're moving to a different model of what the UUMA is and what the ministry is.
I want to pick up on this piece about practice, Clyde, if that's okay, because, you know, in the example you just gave, like there's shared values. Maybe that's the piece about covenant. Like, you know, what is it that's shared among the people in values, in covenant, in culture, in orientation that allows the restorative work to happen when conflicts emerge and harm happens? I think, so one of the training programs I took said that the instructor said that 85% of your restorative work needs to be about building capacity, not about responding to harm or resolving conflict, but about building capacity, and that you do that proactively. And so I guess I'm wondering, and that's about practice. And so she was recommending, like, you should always have restorative circles happening, even when there's not a problem. That having restorative circles when there's not a problem is part of how you build the agreements and the culture and the mindset and the values and the skills, so that you know how to draw on that when the time comes that you need it. I wonder what your thoughts are about that, either of you.
Well, I'm a little worried a restorative circle would be separate and apart from our chapter. I mean, the goal would be restorative circle to share its practice to the point where it's not a group that's often to the side, but a group that's at the very center of the work of the gathered colleagues of that area. That's my only worry, that this technique pulls people out rather than transforms the actual organic UUMA. And it's also the worldview thing. Does the circle engage in proactive practice, or does it also engage in conversation that articulates a new view of what the UUMA is? Because that's what I'm missing, at least I'm just going to say it. I'm missing the worldview work, the view that goes beyond, that doesn't say it's simple, it's a simple practice and it's a simple group of techniques, but rather it's a way of looking at who we are as colleagues that's different than the way we did.
I agree. You can't have, you know, a group of eager colleagues off circling off to the side, you know, talking the good talk without, you know, because if the community is not part of it, it's not, they won't know they won't understand or appreciate what's at stake. So what, you know, there are some, I think it's really important to be aware of that restorative practices we have to, for our purposes at the UMA, we would, you know, really have to have a critical appreciation, I guess, for, you know, that it is also the work of decolonization, and that it's aware of the white supremacy culture that so permeates our institutions and our practices, right? And the power imbalances, and acknowledges the, you know, the really embedded biases that are deep within us. That said, you know, we talk about this thing, two-eyed listening, right? Based on the idea of learning and understanding with a, like a willingness to suspend judgment and a desire to communicate respectfully in a way that challenges like your whatever you believed or held or assumed before. Yeah, so I'm not sure how, you know, you meld the two words, because I don't consider the UUMA embracing Indigenous worldview, nor can it, because it's a, you know, it's a colonial institution. So how then, how do you draw from something that is really of a different culture, in a sense that it can translate and have the kind of impact that you would hope for? I don't know.
That's a question that I feel like we can't ever stop asking, because, you know, restorative, at least in the US, I'm guessing this is true in Canada, Ren, though I don't know that for sure, but at least in the US, the whole professionalized field of restorative justice is a commodification and appropriation. It's like that it is an exercise in that. And I think the reason that is part of the reason that like the field is growing and flourishing is because so many people see the hope and the possibility and the impact that restorative ways can have, especially in comparison to the legalistic ways that are and the punitive ways that so many people have grown up knowing. And so I feel that the question about how the UMA even engages in restorative practices with sufficient, appropriate attention to the realities of appropriation and commodification is like it's a complicated question that I feel it always needs to be at the center of our awareness. I don't have answers. I have a lot of questions though. Claude.
This question of colonization. So who was colonized? Is it simply the European immigrants that are colonized, or did Indigenous America also get colonized? We would argue we were colonized and that we have to decolonize ourselves. And so some of these practices are for at least my people, are practices within a people who were, in a sense, we have elites. We had about 14 families that engaged in slavery. I mean, we had all kinds of things that we have to talk about that are decolonizing for us. So I think that when I look at what happened to the European and to the African, that they were colonized as well. And so the decolonization has to take place with those people. But to say that there were never restorative practices in Scotland, well, we find that there were 1,000 years ago before. So I wouldn't be pessimistic about the nature of that. The UUMA has a lot of people that have been highly colonized and elitized and all kinds of things, because that we give up on the planet. The colonization took us all into the Valley of the Shadow of Death.
From a, I guess, a practical kind of implementation or a practice lens, I think of how much hospitality and the act of co-creating played into all the kind of efforts to resolving our relationships and crises in my family, in my community. So, you know, it may have looked like you know, there was a gathering of people to work or build at something or to create something together, whether it was food or structure or whatever it was. But it was the medium by which that held the long conversations and brought people together. The underpinning message for, you know, that I kept hearing was, we don't give up on people. I guess we give up on the occasional one, but that you don't quit, and it's the process is not just for the healing of those in trouble, but for the well-being of everybody.
Thank you for that. I had more questions, but I think what I want to do now is invite the members of the team, Akash and Jamalu and Diane and Lynn. Are you hearing anything that you want to lift up or comment on, ask a question about?
When I was listening, I was thinking about, I'm actually doing a sermon this Sunday where I was talking about the worldview, like Clyde is talking about how Theodore Parker in his sermon, The Transient and Permanent, was talking about the transient parts of religion being the cultural aspects, the traditions that are brought in versus the permanent, which is a different worldview. It's a worldview of harmony, of peace, of living with nature. And he was talking about how the danger of thinking that the transient or the culture that we have is the same as the other worldview. So it was actually, and if you look at most religions and spiritualities, you see this worldview that is very similar to indigenous people's worldview, basically, which was supposed to counteract the transient part or our culture. But over time, what happened is our culture began to influence the other and over the worldview that was supposed to be about peace and harmony and things like that. So we find ourselves now, as UU ministers, who are very educated, very successful, steeped in this worldview of achievement, of competition, of identifying as something that we aren't. And this is something that a lot of many Buddhism, Hinduism, and all those Eastern religions talk about, this false identification of who we are. And we are steeped in that sort of like a collective mentality. So it's very difficult to even be restorative, to even say that, well, I may have made a mistake. It's sort of like being in competition all the time. As soon as we come together, instead of being able to work that way. So I think that we have the roots of this other worldview at the bottom or at the basis of the original Unitarian Universalism. And we need to turn back to that. And like Parker said, you can get rid of the transient part and the religion is still the same. So we have to shift the transient part, get back to our roots and begin to develop those. That's sort of my point of view. We really need to get back to our roots instead of the culture that carries the colonialism, the patriarchy and all of that. Somehow it's seeped in and it's influencing us, so that it's hard, it's difficult to really even listen to each other.
Go ahead, Lynn, and then Diane.
Thank you both, Ren and Clyde, for your thoughts and ideas that you've shared. I really appreciate it. Clyde, when you were sharing the practice of, say, 14 and 15 year olds who are in conflict, being told, go talk with one another, listen to one another, and then come back and present what you've learned. At least that's what I heard in your story. I hear that as the culture of the whole people being taught and passed on to a younger generation. And some of what I see in Unitarian Universalism are different practices and different cultures happening, whether it's in different congregations or in different chapters. There's such different practices within different chapters, or within our UU youth. I've attended youth cons where there was a restorative circle. And yet that practice isn't reflected in the adult portion of those communities. And so I just wonder about a sense of disorientation, either when youth who've been in those communities that have restorative practices get older, or when any of our colleagues move from one chapter to another, that sense of disorientation. And I yearn for some shared healthy practices that we can continue to return to. And I also hear that because this is all so new and really maybe even hasn't fully begun yet, that we need to be patient. But I am also feeling impatient for some healing. Wonder what you think about our UU individualism of our congregations and our chapters, and how we can best have healthier practices across the board.
We do lose a lot of youth. My mother is a Unitarian, my father was a Cherokee. And so I went to Unitarian churches as a child. And the LRY was actually Unitarian Universalist, because I think at that time. And so when I did all the things that the youth group had taught me, I had that experience of being shocked about the adult church and my initial experience. So I gave up for 25 years the idea that I was going to be a UU minister, because I was horrified. But so I'm not going to, I prefer John's sermon about our permanence, and the religion that's there that's a much better one than the transient culture that drives me nuts. But yeah. The young people, I think, in many of our youth groups around the country today, even though we don't have a national institutional support, are a lot clearer thinking than some of our adult practices. But that's not the way it was in a restorative community. I mean, they would have elders who could share wisdom and stuff like that. And this wasn't unique to North America. I mean, I think this restorative practice is simply the way villages did that on the worldwide way. Villages, I've heard stories from Africa, Central Africa, that are similar.
I think one of the challenges for the UMA is our geographic range. We are clustered in some geographic chapters and some non-geographic chapters as well by various identities. And so this doing restorative practice, or having that as a means of resolving our not necessarily our conflicts, but our relationships, rebuilding relationships and restoring relationships. I think there'll have to be some regional, some people who are regionally gifted and skilled to help guide or facilitate some of that teaching and coaching, perhaps, in those practices, if that is indeed, because I don't think it can happen. It can't happen solely online. There is, I think, there's a very embodied component, I think, to restorative. And we have a lot of challenges just in the nature of our work and the way people are separated geographically and by, so many other challenges. It's not sure how we could effectively talk about a community practice when we have very different cultures and pockets, right? And that the source of our problems or when relationships are in difficulty, there's often some themes there, particular themes, I think, that, in some areas that would require a particular sensitivity, I would think.
Paula Cole Jones has been doing a lot of teaching about that over the years, about communities within communities. And we want to make this approachable to listen to, so we'd like to bring this to a conclusion in a few minutes here. Diane, I think you get the last comment or question. What is it that you'd like to say?
That's always a heavy burden, but I think I can do it fairly quickly. Early on, I think it was Clyde who talked about needing to establish the power of covenant first. And I wanted to share an experience that I had a few months ago. A colleague of ours was leaving their settled ministry and pulled together a concluding worship service. And he invited colleagues, like we always do. We show up at installations and ordinations, and people processed in with our increasingly colorful robes and gorgeous stoles. And then we walked through to up the aisle and we sat in the front. We took the best seats. And when they sat with our backs to the whole congregation that had been gathered there, just like we always do. And the magic, something happened, because he had us, the colleagues, early in the service, which was called a celebration of ministry, turn around and face the gathered congregation, standing up, those of us who could, and read aloud our covenant. And I was moved, like I always am at our ministry days, to read as we are gathered in body our covenant. And there we were facing our congregants and it was right after one of our colleagues have been removed from fellowship, and that I experienced as a terrible betrayal of our covenant. And so I wonder if we could establish a tradition, a pattern, as often as people feel it appropriate, to we rise and face the people gathered and read out loud our covenant. Who better knows our missteps, our faults, than our congregations? And who needs to be humbled than we? And maybe that would help lift up the importance and centrality of covenant. So that's what I was going to raise. Sorry if I sounded like I was rushing, but I was trying to go quick.
No, it was good. Lovely. It sounded impassioned. Thank you. It does really bring us back to your comments about covenant and becoming a people of covenant at the beginning guide. So I think that might be a note we could end on, unless Ren or Clyde, either of you, has a last word you want to say.
Well, we also need to articulate the restorative, that we are a restorative community rather than a punishing community, so that it's not just one, we say it once and then we hope everybody caught it. We got to say that over, and we have to say what restoration means. What does restoration of covenant mean? Does it mean, you understand that if you insult the secession such and you're not going to do it again? Or does it actually mean that there's a restoration of relationships that were broken and that it's going to take more than an apology?
Yeah, I think we're so often focused on being right rather than healing each other. And this idea of fairness or correctness or the right outcome. So I think there's such an opportunity for our personal, our individual development as ministers, and which ties back to covenant, right? As Diane was talking about the covenant. I think we can help each other be better.
I'm here for that.
That example I gave earlier in the conversation about adolescence. So if the adolescents had run through somebody's garden and broken the garden, and they were just to be restored by having a nice conversation and having an elder wiggle the finger, they had to work on the gardens for a while. So some of our restoration needs to be to repair the damage. Doesn't mean it's just apology, it means repair the damage.
Thank you. These are the questions that we hope we'll be discussing in our collegial spaces. So we thank you for watching and hope that it will be a stimulus to your own reflection and discussion with colleagues. And I especially want to thank the members of the Right Relationship team, Diane, Jonalu, Lynn, Om Prakash, for being on the team and those who and part of this discussion, and also those on the team who couldn't be here today. And a special gratitude to you, Clyde, and you, Ren, for coming and being part of this conversation with us. We're really grateful. Thank you.
Thank you.